The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. And I'm going to give you a number of election updates, looking forward to the midterm elections. The first one of those is dated December 18th, which is the day I'm recording. Michelle Morrow, the former Republican candidate for State Superintendent of Public Instruction, filed paperwork on Thursday to run for U.S. Senate, according to her campaign and the North Carolina State Board of Elections. Morrow will challenge Republican frontrunner Michael Whatley, who is running with President Donald Trump's support. The winner of the primary is expected to face former Governor Roy Cooper, a Democrat, in the November election. Whatley said in a statement that he was looking forward to appearing with Trump in Rocky Mount on Friday. "I will be an ally for him and a conservative voice for North Carolina in the U.S. Senate," he said. Last year, Morrow, a critic of public schools who was not widely known at the time, upset GOP incumbent Catherine Truitt in the primary for superintendent of public instruction. She got national attention for social media posts she made calling for the execution of various leaders of the Democratic Party. She lost in the general election to Democrat Mo Green. Since then, Morrow has tried to raise her political profile, registering as a lobbyist and launching a new organization focused on education. She said in March that she was considering a run for Tom Tillis's Senate seat. He later announced his plans to retire. The next article is moving on from the Senate race in North Carolina. It's looking at one of the congressional races. This competitive race for U.S. House could be a rematch. Republican Lori Buckhout announced she is running to face off against incumbent U.S. Representative Don Davis in the 1st District again. This is an article by Krista Dutton, and it was dated December 17th. U.S. Representative Don Davis could be facing a familiar challenger next November in what is anticipated to be one of North Carolina's tightest House races. Retired Army Colonel Lori Buckhout announced Wednesday on a local radio station she's running in the Republican primary for North Carolina's 1st District. "I'm coming back home to run for the 1st Congressional District," Buckhout said on the talk show Talk of the Town with host Henry Hinton. "We are going to win it." Buckhout, who left her post as the White House's Assistant National Cyber Director for Policy in October, narrowly lost to Davis in 2024. But the district looks different now. Republicans in the state legislature redrew the congressional lines in October, making the 1st District, which now spans the northeast part of the state from the Virginia border to the coast, more conservative. In her last run for Congress, Buckhout campaigned on tightening border security, lowering inflation, and protecting gun rights. She secured Trump's endorsement and raised about $4.7 million per FEC filings. She came within 6,307 votes of Davis in 2024. The Republican primary is crowded. Other candidates include Republican State Senator Bobby Hannig, Carteret County Sheriff Asa Buck, Lenoir County Board of Commissioners Vice Chairman Eric Rouse, and family law attorney Ashley Nicole Russell. The National Republican Congressional Committee, House Republicans' official campaign arm, doesn't endorse in open primaries and is having conversations with all Republican candidates who have filed, per a source familiar. Republicans are eager to flip the 1st District, which has repeatedly been impacted by redistricting. Each time Davis has run for Congress, his district's boundaries have been redrawn. The district is in a rural part of the state with a large black population. A black representative has led the district since 1992, and voters there have not elected a woman since 2000. About 18% of people live below the poverty line. Davis told Notus earlier this year that he plans to emphasize housing, healthcare, job creation, and infrastructure needs in his campaign. Of the 23 counties in the newly drawn district, 15 went for Trump in 2024. But that doesn't faze Davis. People across the country are watching what North Carolina has done, but it's only for one part of the state, just the East. Leave us alone. We're resilient. We'll figure it out. We're okay electing Donald Trump and Don Davis. We're okay with that, he previously told us. And here's another election-related article, this time about the 4th Congressional District. The 4th Congressional District primary just got interesting. This is an article by Chase Pellegrini DePauw and was written December 11th. Durham County Commissioner Nida Alam will file to run for the seat Thursday, challenging Representative Valerie Fushi in a near replay of the 2022 race. Durham County Commissioner Nida Alam will challenge incumbent U.S. Representative Valerie Fushi in the March Democratic primary. The 4th Congressional District includes all of Durham and Orange counties, as well as Northern Chatham and Western Wake. Alam will file Thursday, setting up a rematch between the two biggest contenders in the district's 2022 Democratic primary, which became the most expensive congressional primary in state history. Fushi won that election by 9 percentage points and did not draw a challenger in 2024 from her own party. In an exclusive interview with The Indy, Alam said she is running again because she's disappointed by Fushi's record. She has been in office for 3 years, said Alam. What has been accomplished? In an email statement to The Indy after Alam's announcement, Fushi said, "You can look at my record to show that I am not just paying lip service to our shared progressive values, but instead working to advance legislation like the ICE Badge Visibility Act, the Dignity for Detained Immigrants Act, and the Block the Bombs Act." Fushi filed for re-election on December 1st, calling her 2 terms in Congress one of my life's greatest honors in a press release. Alam and Fushi align on many policies like combating climate change and expanding access to Medicare, which are expected stances in the bluest district in North Carolina. While the candidates have sharp disagreements on campaign finance and the war in Gaza, voters may end up looking for differences in vibes and messaging more than actual policy objectives. Fushi, who won her first local election when Alam was 4 years old, has deep relationships in the district and a longer track record for constituents to judge. Alam, 32, is gambling that voters want generational change and will favour an outspoken and social media savvy candidate. Alam contrasted Fushi with David Price, who represented the district for over 20 years, though the district's boundaries moved several times and Price lost re-election once in the 1990s. No matter what, David showed up for this district, said Alam. When ICE and CBP are here, kidnapping your neighbours, a tweet or a strongly worded letter is not going to reassure anyone. The way that you can fight back against that is you need organisers in Congress. In her Thursday email to The Indy, Fushi said, "I am ensuring the people of NC04 have a voice in Washington by voting against the National Defense Authorization Act, the Republican continuing resolution, and the big ugly bill that prioritized tax breaks for the wealthy over the needs of working families." Fushi first won election to the Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools Board in 1997 and then worked her way up through Orange County government, including stretches on the county commission and in the state house and state senate, before running to fill Price's seat after his retirement. Fushi was the first black woman to hold several of those roles. Alam has served on the Durham County Board of Commissioners since 2020 and was the first Muslim woman to hold public office in the state. She worked as political director for U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders during his 2016 presidential run and was vice chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party from 2017 to 2021. She is currently the vice chair of the county commission after serving a term as chair. The 2022 Alam Fushi matchup was defined by outside money spent to elect Fushi, including over $2 million from pro-Israel groups like American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or IPAC. In the 2 years since the current war in Gaza began, local governments have passed resolutions to denounce the war, including in Durham and Carborough. Some politicians and activists saw those resolutions as a way to put pressure on Fushi. Carborough's resolution urged the local congressional delegation to join us, while Durham's included a clause that the resolution be forwarded to Fushi and then-President Joe Biden. Alam, at the time, penned an op-ed criticising Fushi's decision to travel to Israel in March 2024. Earlier this year, the Indy reported that Fushi said at a Carborough town hall that she will not accept IPAC money in the 2026 election. The question for Asher Hildebrand, the former chief of staff to Price and now a professor of public policy at Duke University, is how much of that sticks to Fushi if we're relitigating things that happened 4 years ago. Alam believes the 2022 money, as well as recent donations to Fushi from PACs affiliated with Lockheed Martin, Walmart and Northrop Grumman, show that the incumbent is a corporate Democrat, per a press release from Alam announcing her candidacy. Alam enters the race with an endorsement from Sanders, an indication that she will lean into economic populist messaging in contrast to Fushi. Neither is a proven fighter with the courage to take on corporate power, billionaires and billionaire-funded super PACs like IPAC, Sanders said via Alam's release. The shape of the district has also changed a bit since 2022. Portions of Alamance, Caswell, Granville and Person counties have been removed and replaced by a jagged portion of Western Wake that stretches from Morrisville to Fuquay-Varina Arena. It also includes the northern portion of Chatham. Hildebrand cautioned against making any assumptions about who those new boundaries may favour. In its iteration then and now, even though it has portions of other counties, Durham, as a community, as a population centre, is the centre of gravity in the district, Hildebrand said. So one interesting question might be, what's changed in Durham? One big change, Hildebrand noted, is that each candidate now likely has higher name recognition than a few years ago. Alam, from her years on the County Commission, and Fushi, from her 2 terms in Congress. The candidates' lists of endorsements also give some clues as to their strengths. Fushi's 50 endorsers are a who's who of state and local politics, including Governor Josh Stein, former Governor Roy Cooper, nearly every state representative and senator in her district, Durham Mayor Leo Williams, and the sheriffs of Chatham, Durham and Orange counties. Alam has secured several high-profile out-of-town endorsements, including from activist David Hogg and the leaders of progressive organisations Justice Democrats, Sunrise Movement and the Working Families Party. Democrat Mary Patterson has also filed to run for the seat. She did not appear to have a campaign website and has not yet responded to our request for information. Republican Max Ganorkar has also filed to run. His website calls on residents to be an anti-socialism warrior. Ganorkar ran unsuccessfully in the 2024 Republican primary for the seat. He's unlikely to gain much traction in a district that, per the Cook Political Report, trends Democratic by more than 20 points and has a core in Durham and Orange counties that voted for Kamala Harris with 75% and 80% of the vote, respectively. The primary election is on March 3rd. Early voting starts on February 12th. Our final article for today is from the Courts and Justice section, an article by Kyle Perotti. Spruce Pine Police shocked a diabetic man and he is suing. Dylan Nedford doesn't remember getting punched and shocked by a trio of police officers in a Walmart parking lot, but security footage tells the story. Ledford was driving from his girlfriend's house in Yancey County to his home in Marion on the evening of February 16, 2024, when he felt his blood sugar dropping. Ledford has type 1 diabetes, so he knew it could be dangerous to drive unless he found something to eat. He pulled into the parking lot of the Spruce Pine Walmart Supercenter. At 8:13 p.m., the store's security footage shows Ledford walking inside, wearing thigh-length pink shorts, a black hoodie and a backward hat. A few minutes later, he walked back out to his girlfriend's yellow Mini Cooper. At 8:52, he was in the throes of hypoglycemic shock and talking incoherently when two associates bringing an order out to another vehicle noticed him and thought he was acting weird. One associate told their boss about him, adding that Ledford's twitching scared her. The manager checked on Ledford several minutes later, then called 911 to request a welfare check. "He's just got those big buggy eyes and he's not answering anybody, and he's twitching," the manager told dispatch, according to a transcript of the call. When Spruce Pine police officers Michael Sale and Dalton Mace arrived at the scene, they attempted to talk to Ledford, according to the video and an arrest report. He was unable to respond and didn't react when Sale shined a flashlight in his face or asked him to leave his vehicle. The two officers and police captain, Michael Holyfield, who arrived a few minutes into the encounter, removed Ledford from the car, but the trio had trouble cuffing him. The male was given verbal commands to leave the property or be charged with trespassing, Sale's arrest report said. The male still did not respond to law enforcement officers on scene. At that time, the male was extracted from the vehicle and assisted onto the asphalt. The male became resistant by tensing his body up and not complying with verbal commands to place his hands behind his back. Sale then struck Ledford around the torso several times, the video shows. Holyfield used a taser on him twice. They forced him onto his stomach, cuffed him and charged him with one count of second-degree trespassing and three counts of resisting arrest. None of the officers administered medical aid or requested assistance. Once he was released from custody, Ledford's girlfriend, whom he's since married, took him to the hospital where he was treated for minor injuries. A few days later, Ledford filed a complaint with the Spruce Pine Police Department against the three officers and requested that they be suspended pending a full investigation. Nearly 9 months later, the department issued a statement saying that District Attorney R. Seth Banks had cleared the officers following a State Bureau of Investigation inquiry. When Ledford resisted arrest, they feared he may have had a weapon, as Sale wrote in the arrest report. Now, Ledford is suing the officers, the town of Spruce Pine, and Police Chief Casey Cook, arguing that the ordeal left him with symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder and has prevented him from finding work. At no time did the plaintiff create a dangerous situation or place any officer or member of the public in danger, his suit states. Through his attorney, David Wickrama, Ledford, now 31, declined to comment for this story, but many of the events described in the suit align with the store's security video, which Wickrama provided to the Assembly. The incident is the latest in a series of complaints about North Carolina Police Department's use of tasers and their internal guidelines for the devices. The lawsuit also questions how officers deal with medical emergencies. Cook, the Spruce Pine police chief, referred questions to the department's legal counsel, which did not respond to multiple requests for comment. In their response to the lawsuit, the officers denied that they used excessive force. The legal response included little detail but broadly rejected Ledford's allegations that the officers should have known he was in diabetic shock and provided aid. "Don't tase me." Ledford's suit, filed in June, claims that Holyfield's use of taser constituted excessive force. Tasers, which are a product of the company Axon Enterprise, have two modes: dart, which ejects probes attached to wires to electrocute a person from up to 45 feet away, and drive stun, in which the prongs are pressed against someone's body and used like a cattle prod. According to the suit and the arrest report, Holyfield used drive stun on Ledford twice. The American Diabetes Association has said that tasers can be particularly harmful for those with diabetes. The use of CEDs on individuals with diabetes is particularly significant because of the potentially adverse effects of such force on the endocrine system, which is already compromised with individuals with diabetes as well as other systems. A 2016 federal court ruling regarding Pinehurst's use of tasers said police can only use serious, injurious force like a taser when an objectively reasonable officer would conclude that the circumstances present a risk of immediate danger. In other words, Staunton said, the taser is a defensive weapon. The video shows Ledford resisting arrest, but it doesn't show him attempting to harm anyone. Ledford's suit said he never put the officers or the public in danger. Cook and the town of Spruce Pine denied the assertion in a legal response, while the officers said they lacked sufficient information or knowledge to respond to the allegation. In May, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously that courts must consider all the relevant circumstances, including the seriousness of the event that drew officers' attentions, which in Ledford's case was a welfare check call, when determining whether the use of force was appropriate. In a 2023 annual operator training update, PowerPoint slide deck, which Wikie Wikrama provided to the Assembly, Axon states that tasers should not be used for verbal defiance, belligerence or punishment. The suit claims that the department's policy manual lacked any guidance on taser use. A copy of the manual, dated November 1, 1991, obtained by the Assembly, showed no specific guidelines for use of tasers. The lawsuit asserts that the manual was unchanged as of 2024. In court filings, Cook and the town denied that without elaborating. They did not comment further or provide an updated manual to the Assembly. In the filings, they also rejected Ledford's claim that officers were allowed to use tasers without receiving a policy or annual training, and they broadly rejected his arguments that stun gun use wasn't properly regulated. The three officers who responded to the Spruce Pine Walmart said in their response to the lawsuit that they had all had taser training, but did not clarify if they had received training within the last year. There have been numerous cases regarding taser deployment in North Carolina in recent years. In Warrenton, an officer was indicted after it was determined there was probable cause that he'd used excessive force, including deploying his taser in separate incidents in 2022 and 2023. Four people filed a lawsuit in October alleging that improper training and policies contributed to the officer's excessive use of force. Raleigh officials recently agreed to pay nearly $1 million to settle a lawsuit from a mother whose son died after officers shocked him with a taser. The Wake County Sheriff's Office stopped equipping patrol deputies with tasers in 2019 after a Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling said that taser use can be seen as excessive force in some instances. But last month, the county entered into a $1.4 million contract with Axon to provide 200 tasers. Wake County Sheriff Willie Rowe told WRAL that an enhanced threat environment now necessitates their use. 2 months after the encounter with Ledford, Sale made headlines when he struck a 21-year-old woman in the head several times while trying to arrest her. Sale was suspended and subsequently cleared of any wrongdoing by the district attorney. Missing the signs. Ledford's lawsuit claims the Spruce Pine officers should have known he may have been experiencing a medical crisis, which they disputed in their response. When the Walmart associates alerted their boss that Ledford was having an issue in his car, they mentioned that he was behaving strangely, twitching, and not speaking coherently, according to the 911 call. Staunton said that officers must consider that someone who fails to obey commands isn't necessarily resisting. They should be open to the possibility that there could be circumstances they're not aware of, such as a medical issue that makes it impossible to either hear or comprehend commands. Furthermore, he said that someone who may seem intoxicated could be experiencing any number of medical issues. Even if they are intoxicated to the point of incoherence, that itself should be considered a medical concern. While the arrest report doesn't mention whether officers thought Ledford was intoxicated, the Walmart staff members had mentioned that they thought he might have been under the influence of narcotics. The police report states that officers didn't ask if Ledford was diabetic until he was seen laying on his left side at the police station, even though he struggled to communicate in the patrol vehicle in transit from Walmart to the station. When an officer noticed Ledford laying down, apparently in distress, he didn't render medical aid. He offered some crackers and Mountain Dew, the arrest report says. The shorthand here is, if it could be a medical emergency, you treat it like it is until a medical professional tells you it is not. Staunton said that such a mindset would not only save lives, it could save taxpayers money from civil suits. I worked on a case out of New Jersey where an officer arrested someone for DUI because the officer completely missed the symptoms, the very obvious symptoms, the person having a stroke. And the jury awarded something like $16 million in that case, he said. Ledford's suit argues that the officer should have rendered medical aid or requested an ambulance, even if they were arresting him. Staunton said that while an officer can't diagnose a medical issue, they can observe and treat symptoms and injuries. In fact, he said, they are legally required to err on the side of rendering or calling for medical aid. Officers do not have the professional training, the knowledge, the expertise to be able to say there is or is not a medical emergency. So if there might be one, you call the ambulance and you let them figure it out. On October 31st, U.S. Magistrate Judge W. Carlton Metcalf set a preliminary trial date for Ledford's lawsuit on January 11th, 2027 in Asheville's federal court. The charges against Ledford for trespassing and resisting arrest were dismissed 8 months after the encounter with police, but according to the suit, the damage to his professional reputation had already been done. Ledford's name was entered into the Criminal Justice Law Enforcement Automated Data Services, a secure, centralized database of information about offenders for use by state and federal law enforcement. His mugshot also appeared in print in a now-defunct local crime blog, which published mugshots of people booked into county jails along with charges and offered a punny quip about their alleged crimes. Ledford still works as a state correctional officer and canine handler, as he did at the time of the arrest. The suit claims that in October 2024, he applied for a higher-paying job with Burke County Sheriff's Office, but was turned down as a direct result of the plaintiff's inclusion in CJ Leeds. Burke County didn't respond to an information request seeking to verify this claim. Ledford has also tried and failed to land higher-paying positions with other agencies, says the suit, which posits that the reason his inclusion, is his inclusion in CJ Leeds. Ultimately, the suit argues that Ledford now faces barriers to a career in law enforcement that he may never surmount. As a result of the defendant's actions and violation of plaintiff's rights, plaintiff has suffered damages, the suit reads, including but not limited to medical expenses, pain and suffering, mental and emotional injuries, and damage to reputation. As for the Spruce Pine Walmart Supercenter, the suit says, plaintiff remains banned to this day. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.